From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Thousands of people have gathered tonight in St. Peter's Square in Rome and in churches around the world as the health of Pope John Paul II continues to deteriorate. The Pope received the last rites of the church yesterday. This morning, with John Paul reported near death, his staff announced the appointment of a flurry of new bishops and archbishops. In this hour, we will keep a close eye and ear on the news from the Vatican. Pope John Paul leaves a deep imprint on the Catholic Church and beyond. In his 26 years at the head of the Catholic Church, he crusaded against communism, denounced unbridled capitalism, and spoke against political repression. He took more than 100 trips abroad. He won deep support. He also alienated some Catholics, for with his conservative social positions on gay rights, on abortion, on the role of women. Tonight on Point, the Roman Catholic Church and the world confront the fading light of Pope John Paul II. We begin tonight in Rome with the latest news from the Vatican. Sophie Airy has been covering the story for the Christian Science Monitor. She joins me now. Sophie Airy, thanks for being with us tonight.
Pleasure.
What's the latest?
Well, the crowds are still gathering in St. Peter's Square in a very somber vigil, really keeping company with the Pope in his last hours. It's been an incredibly emotional day here. Really, for the first time, we've had months of watching this aged and frail Pope struggling with illness. And yet, until today, there hasn't really been a public acknowledgement that he might die. And even now, the Vatican have really made it clear that they believe he is going through his last hours. Cardinal Camillo Ruini, giving a mass this evening, said that he thought the Pope already sees and touches the Lord. So the message is loud and clear now to all Catholics around the world that the Vatican itself expects John Paul to die very, very soon.
Sophie, what exactly has been said about the precise medical details of the Pope's condition? What's known at this point?
Well, we've had an extraordinary amount of information, given how secretive the Vatican has been in the past. We've had three bulletins today, each giving us an update in detail on the Pope's condition, the latest of which indicated that his breathing is becoming increasingly shallow and weak, that his blood pressure is low, and that his organs are failing, his kidneys and his heart. There have been other unconfirmed reports that he has lost consciousness, but the Vatican hasn't actually confirmed that yet or at any point. In fact, it's denied it quite vigorously earlier on in the day. So we know that his condition is deteriorating more and more seriously. And yet, we still have to wait. He may hold out for many hours more. We had earlier this evening warning that another bulletin was due, and it never came, which suggests that the condition of the Pope is changing so fast that the Vatican is waiting to the right moment to give a clear message to the Catholic world that is now waiting and praying all over the globe.
Sophie, earlier today we saw wire reports that the Italian media was reporting that the Pope had actually died. The Vatican moved very quickly to squelch, to deny those reports.
Well, there's been a series of rumours during the day today. Earlier on we heard that the Pope was in a coma, and the Vatican also dismissed that as rubbish. This happens. It's very difficult to establish exactly what's going on in the corridors of the Vatican. We are dependent on the short and succinct statements that are issued, and on messages that filter through, often from unnamed sources, and that's how these more extreme reports emerge. We have no real way of being able to confirm and can only go on what the Vatican is prepared to officially say, and so far the Vatican is very strongly denying that the Pope has died or that he has lost consciousness.
And very specifically, when John Paul II's death finally comes, how will the world learn that? Do you expect it in an announcement, a piece of paper, the ringing of bells? What's anticipated when the moment finally comes?
There's a very specific procedure, a very, very old ritual of the Vatican, which comes into play at every point at which a pope dies. And this will be played out again. And the way it works is that a nominated cardinal, in this case a Spanish cardinal, Martinez Somalo, becomes what they call in Italian the camerlengo, which is the chamberlain. He becomes effectively the interim pope from the moment at which this pope is declared to be dead. And the first job for that camerlengo is to ascertain that the pope has died and then to pass on this message so that it can be given out publicly both to diplomats and other Vatican officials and to the public at large. So what will happen is that in the Pope's room, where he is now lying with his closest aides and with his doctors, the camerlengo will officially confirm that he is dead. In the past, traditionally, that's been done in a very strange fashion, it might appear now, where a little silver hammer is used to tap on the forehead of the Pope just to make sure mm-hmm. he's no longer there. Mm-hmm. And his name used to be repeated three times, after which, if there was no response, it was declared that he was dead. It's not nowadays the practice that's likely to be used, but in the same way, it will be the camerlengo's job to establish and announce that the Pope has gone. After that, a very quick series of precautions are taken. Firstly, the Pope's ring and his seal are destroyed so that it's not possible for anybody to forge any document in his name from the moment at which he's gone. Mm-hmm. Secondly, his room is sealed so that his belongings and any documents in the room can't be removed. And from that point, the Vicar of Rome will then announce publicly that the Pope is dead, and that is the point at which we will receive the message. We don't know exactly how that message will be delivered, whether it will be given in the form of an interview with one of the Italian leading media organisations, or whether it will be given in the form of a written statement, but it will come from Cardinal Camillo Ruini.
And Sophie Eri, in St. Peter's Square tonight at the Vatican, how would you describe the mood?
Well, it's very, very sad, but in a sense, there's a crowd that's gathered of young and old people alike, foreigners and Italians. And whilst they're sad, they have all known that this time has to come and have been well prepared for it. And in a sense, what they're doing is paying tribute to this Pope by coming out and being with him as he goes through his last hours of suffering. There are lots of people talking about their memories of him and with smiles rather than tears now.
A kind of acceptance.
There's a lot of respect for mm-hmm. this man, and there's a lot of sense that other things that during his papacy, Italians haven't necessarily supported everything he has stood for. He's been quite an authoritarian, conservative pope on family matters in particular. But when it comes to it, he's been a very, very respected and admired man overall, and that's why people are turning out now.
Sophie Eri in Rome tonight. Thank you so much for your report. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Sophie Eri, Rome correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with me from Rome. We are bringing you live coverage tonight of the latest from the Vatican and talking about the future of the Catholic Church. You can join the conversation. What are your thoughts on Pope John Paul II and the road ahead for the Roman Catholic Church tonight? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from South Orange, New Jersey, is Monsignor Robert Sheeran. He's president of Seton Hall University, the leading figure in Catholic education in the United States. Well, Monsignor Sheeran, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Your thoughts as the Vatican girds itself for, apparently, the passing of the Pope this evening?
Right. Well, I think we are all very aware that this is a big pontificate, big in terms of its length, big in terms of the teaching and the writing of the Holy Father, big in terms of world influence, big in terms of the affection he holds in the hearts of countless people. So there's a great sadness that someone who's been around the world stage and leading the church for more than a quarter of a century is passing, and then there's thoughts of the future.
We'll look at those thoughts after a moment. We've got a break coming up here, but I just wonder, you studied in Rome as a young for the priesthood as a young man. You know the Vatican well. Your personal emotions tonight, Monsignor.
Well, I lived in Rome for 9 years, and toward the end of that time, I was there for the election of John Paul II. I was there when he was installed as Pope, and I can remember him walking out of St. Peter's, and I can remember the first words he uttered, that day, do not be afraid. And in a sense, that encouragement to the church, to the world, really has defined this papacy. It's a man who is a man of immense courage, and I think he's done many things for the church, but I think he's encouraged us to be a church that speaks out, a church that cares, and a church that tries to make a difference in the world.
Monsignor Robert Sheeran, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. Live coverage here tonight of the fate and imprint of Pope John Paul II. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Nel nome del Padre, del Figlio e dello Spirito Santo.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are bringing you live coverage tonight of the fate and imprint of Pope John Paul II. Behind us, an Italian priest praying earlier today at the Vatican. The Vatican acknowledging today that the Pope is in very grave condition, and Rome and really the world girding for what is expected soon, very likely, news of his death. You can join our conversation tonight. What are your thoughts tonight as Pope John Paul II struggles with death? How will you remember the Polish Pope? We'll be hearing tonight from around the country and around the world. We're joined right now by Monsignor Robert Sheeran, president of Seton Hall University, a leading figure in Catholic education in the United States. Good enough to join us tonight. I wonder what you make, Robert Sheeran, of the Pope's image of suffering in these recent days and weeks and really years now. This is a man who was an actor and playwright in his youth, and I don't mean that this is theater. Nevertheless, there's a kind of theater. He has not stinted in showing, in sharing his struggle with human frailty, physical frailty, mortality at the end.
Yes, it's interesting. Aside of the Pope, most people don't realize is he's a published poet, and he's written a couple of volumes of fascinating poems. But the theme of suffering and an awareness of death play out throughout his writings from his very earliest days. His very first poem in the late 1930s was a poem written reflecting on his own mother's death and the suffering involved there, and the hope that comes from the resurrection. And even before he was Pope, he had a very interesting poem in the early 70s that say, I see my life slipping away and the coffin of my life opening, and I trust that God will bring me through this suffering that is ahead. There's a lot of deep reflection in this man's life. He's a man of immense action, but he's also a genuine contemplative in many ways as well. So he understands suffering at a very deep, very real, very faith-filled level, that through suffering, life and goodness arises. In faith, that makes sense, but without faith, it's a little bit difficult.
Therefore, his own physical suffering becomes a kind of symbol to the Catholic faithful?
Sure. We're celebrating Easter during these days. It's through death that life arises. Paul VI once said, a pope dies like any other man, but he dies publicly. And John Paul II has realized that his life is a very open book. Everything he does publicly. I can remember attending his very early morning masses were never private affairs. People came in from all over the world. There were only 20 or 30 people there. They were public. Everything he did was public. Was he an actor? Well, he was someone that was used to being on a public stage and realized that was his destiny. And I think he's realized for years his falling apart, his becoming old and incapacitated is part of the role that he plays.
He has been a very strong leader in the Catholic Church. He's been widely admired for exercising that authority. By some, he's been called authoritarian within the Catholic Church. How do those views break down? Who sees this pope how? What kind of opening instinct leads one Catholic or another to see him as a strong and marvelous leader or too heavy-handed as a leader?
Well, I suppose that depends on what part of the spectrum someone is, where someone is at. If someone doesn't like authority, he's certainly an authoritarian. I think that, from the perspective of faith, he's a man of immense vigor and energy, a man of great intellect, and a man who loves the Lord very much. He sees the role of the Pope as, in his very first writings, his first encyclical, he points out Jesus Christ. He is there to point out Jesus Christ as the source and the center of the Christian life and of human history, and he intends to do that without any fear.
Monsignor Robert Sheeran, President of Seton Hall University, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from New York City, Father James Heft. He's Professor of Faith and Culture and Chancellor of the University of Dayton, a Catholic college. Father James Heft, thank you for joining us tonight.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
It's great to have you. And also with us tonight in the studio again, Stephen Pope, Associate Professor of Theology at Boston College. He was good enough to be with us last night as we began to follow this story, and he's with us again tonight. Stephen Pope, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Tom.
Father James Heft, the issue of succession arises quickly. The Pope is still there. We respect that, but the Vatican itself is acknowledging tonight that he is very likely in his last hours. What do you see ahead for the Catholic Church as the baton is passed forward? What are the major issues that are likely to arise?
Well, I think there are a couple things here. One of the most interesting things is a little bit of history. In the last, let's say, 200, 250 years, I think in general we've been blessed with very good popes. If you go to the 10th century, you'll see a nightmare of popes. And it's a wonder the Church survived. For believers, it's because the Spirit ultimately led the Church. But in the last 200, 250 years, we always see this. We see anybody that has been in a long time, and this Pope has certainly been in a long time as Pope, and secondly, anyone who at the same time has left a very strong stamp on things, and this guy has certainly done that, it doesn't matter how many cardinals he's appointed, the pendulum usually swings. Now, having said that...
Meaning, even though he's kind of filled the ranks with his own appointees, a pendulum swing in perspective.
Yeah, but even there, I think that's an overstatement that the press usually uses. There's a variety of people there, but,
Just by longevity, so many appointees are, of course, under his time.
True, fair enough. Not all appointees speak their minds publicly. You watch what happens in a conclave, and you'll see probably what the majority of his appointees really think.
And the kind of pendulum swing that you anticipate that you've seen as the historical pattern?
Well, this is harder to tell. If you look at his record on the public stage, Monsignor Sheeran was just talking about this, I heard before. Who would have thought 150 years ago that the Pope would be a principal defender of human rights on the international stage? Who? I mean... the popes 150 years ago were reacting against all the movements towards freedom of the press, freedom of conscience, and so on. So here you've got someone that's been on that public stage, a person who's been an architect of a conversation with world religions, absolutely tremendous, a person who has forged relationships with the Jews that are unprecedented. All these things have been extraordinary. On the other side of the coin, you have someone who, particularly from Europe and the United States, has been slow to move on issues that have been particularly vexing, issues of the role of women, certain issues of sexual morality, so on and so forth. So when you ask the pendulum, when is it going to swing, how is it going to swing, it's harder to say, especially since this time we have many more third world cardinals who will be voting than ever before. So the rule that I enunciated at the beginning, that over the last 200, 250 years, may be harder to interpret in this particular papal election. It'll be very interesting to see how it unfolds.
Such a kind of Rubik's Cube of issues here. Hard to picture the trajectory of a pendulum swing. Monsignor Robert Sheeran, you've paid particular attention to the changing demographics of the Catholic Church. I wish you'd describe those for us and the direction in which they are propelling things.
I think one of the big issues before the next pope is the demographics of the Church, moving from the northern to the southern hemisphere. The Catholic majority in the years to come will be in Africa, South America, Philippines, and Southern Asia. And, you know, they're all Catholics, but they live their faith and perceive their faith in different ways, as Italians do from the Irish. So I think we can expect many different influences, growing in the Church in the years to come.
And what about a pope from the Southern Hemisphere?
Quite possible. We have, who would have thought of a pope from Poland 25 years ago? So a pope from Nigeria or India or Brazil is quite possible today.
Monsignor Robert Sheeran, president of Seton Hall University, we're very grateful to you for being with us tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Father James Heft, University of Dayton chancellor, joining us from New York City. Thank you very much for being with
us
tonight.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
We turn now to Rome. We're joined there by Bill Thorne. He is associate professor of journalism at Marquette University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. In Rome tonight, he specializes in media and religion and has been a communications consultant to the Vatican for a quarter century. Bill Thorne, thank you for joining us this evening.
Yeah, you're entirely welcome.
We know how late it is there, but it's been a day, a rare kind of day in Rome and at the Vatican. Have you been at the Vatican today, Bill?
Here it's Saturday morning, no, but I was there noon Friday and again last night for a portion of the public rosary and prayer that took place here from 9 o'clock until about 9:45 our time in Rome.
Bill, you've been very close to the Vatican on their communications in a time when they've had a powerful communicator at the head of the Church. How do you interpret the way in which the news of the last several days has come out? How do you interpret what is there something that we may not understand about how it's this news is being revealed, held back? How do you interpret the posture, the public posture of the Vatican right now?
Well, I think for many people, the extraordinary thing about the Vatican has been its openness, beginning with the Pope's first rushed trip to Policlinico Gemelli,
the hospital there, yes.
Breathing problems. Mm-hmm. In the past, you may recall the great struggle to get the Vatican to admit that he indeed had Parkinson's.
Yes.
And so there was an assumption that when his health deteriorated further, that the Vatican would be reluctant to say much. And indeed, it's almost been the exact opposite in the last 2 months. Journalists here in Rome have had no trouble getting stories out about how the machinery of the Vatican continues, about the health of the Pope. And I think in the last 2 weeks, as his condition deteriorated and he was unable to speak, the Vatican has been extremely open with this. And today, one of the most extraordinary things for me was watching Joaquin Navarro-Valls, the spokesman for the Vatican, begin to weep at 12:30 this afternoon at his press conference. And then he apologized and said that in the 20-some years he's worked with the Vatican, he's never seen the Pope like this. Well, for anybody around here, that was a clear signal that there was not likely to be a recovery from this one.
Bill Thorne in Rome, please stand by. Stephen Pope here in the studio with me. You've been good enough to follow this drama over the last couple of days with us. Here we are tonight. First, your thoughts, where we are in the arc of this drama at the Vatican, how you're taking it on board, how Catholics that you're in touch with are taking it on board.
Well, Tom, I think there's an enormous amount of interest around the world, and the media is sure responding to that interest. I think everyone knows this is not just an intra-Catholic issue, an event. It's really an event for the world of historic proportions. It's difficult to deal with death in a person who's had so much impact on history because you wonder what's going to happen afterwards. this is both a strength and a weakness in a way of this pontificate. Let me explain briefly.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by that is that the Pope has become the most charismatic Pope probably in the history of the Church, and at least through the use of the media and transportation, he's the most well-known Pope. And so many people identify him with the Catholic Church in toto that now that he is seeing his last stage of life, people wonder what's going to happen to the Catholic Church.
Because of his character, because of his charisma, and because all of that has been amplified through modern media, which really grew into its full form in his time in the Vatican.
Right, and so there's a tendency to confuse the strength of the Pope in his own person with the Church as a whole. And I think one of the valuable things about the funeral is it's a way of people knowing and seeing that the Church is much broader, much deeper than one person, and something, of course, he would insist on himself. He's always really wanting to point to Christ, not to himself. But I think all the exposure has given him so much identification with the Catholic Church that it's causing a lot of people to be nervous about it, and I think unnecessarily so.
Mm. Bill Thorne, you're very familiar with how this Pope could fill a room, could fill a screen, could fill a vast public space with his charisma, with his message.
Exactly. In fact, we've not seen one like this before. It's true the technology of media has not been there before, except very late under Paul VI. But this Pope was a man who clearly understood media, and the documents I worked with and the time I've worked with the Vatican communications people, there's never been a question about his understanding exactly where the media was going and the role of media in contemporary culture. And he stepped forward as pointed out, as a central figure representing Catholicism, but also I gather from people I've talked to and observed, somebody who stands simply for faith. And for those who are not Catholic, he stands as someone who encourages faithful behavior, and the ecumenical movement we talked about earlier is very much part of that.
Mm. Stephen Pope.
He understands how to be there and how to especially encourage the young. I think we older people certainly underestimate how powerful a symbol he is, how powerful an influence he is on those under 30.
Stephen Pope, a man as big as the very big media, maybe bigger in the way he's used it.
Yes, and I would add to what Bill just said, that it's the first Pope who is also an actor. And I don't mean that in any cynical way, but someone who knows.
But literally, by his youthful inclination, he aspired to be an actor. He was a playwright.
And he is a man who understands the significance of gesture. Gesture before the Wailing Wall, the gesture on the tarmac.
This is just when he went to Jerusalem, he put the prayer and the apology into the Wailing Wall,
exactly.
Reconciling the Catholic Church with the Jews.
And the gesture you almost always see him in, the most common gesture is him kneeling at prayer.
Mm-hmm. Bill Thorne, you've seen many people interact with the media, with great publics. Give us a sense of how this Pope thought about it, the gesture, the dramatic awareness of this Pope. How keenly evident was that?
Well, I it's almost instinctual because the man is so authentic. I've dealt with people in media who seem marvelously wonderful, warm, and all the rest. The lights go off, the camera goes off, and you discover that it's a very different person there. But with this Pope, it was not the case. And I think that's one of the things that resonated with the youth, was his authenticity. But the gestures, he understands, they have, as they say in Mass, a great drama, a liturgical drama, in which gestures are particularly important.
Bill, you're there in Rome. You may well be advising the Vatican in the days ahead. What do you see as the Vatican's, the Church's biggest challenge now, with the passage of this Pope, it seems imminent, their biggest challenge in the days and weeks ahead?
Well, there will be a dramatic transition. He is leaving an enormous vacuum, whether it's World Youth Day or whether it's Easter Sunday or any other Sunday or a Wednesday afternoon audience. He has been the face and voice of the church, and he's loomed as large as any political figure you care to name in the last 50 years or more.
Unmistakably so. Bill Thorne, tonight in Rome as the Pope struggles for his life. Thank you very much for joining us, Bill.
You're welcome.
Bill Thorne, Associate Professor of Journalism at Marquette University and a longtime communications consultant to the Vatican. Stephen Pope with me in the studio. Please stand by. We're talking tonight, bringing you live coverage of the fate and imprint of Pope John Paul II. You can join us. How will you remember the Polish Pope? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
È il figlio mio prediletto, nel quale mi sono compiaciuto.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are bringing you live coverage tonight of the fate and imprint of Pope John Paul II, struggling for his life tonight, struggling at the threshold of death, the Vatican indicates, in Rome. You can join the conversation tonight. How will you remember the Polish Pope? How do you interpret the suffering he's freely shown the world in his last years and days? And are you thinking tonight beyond this Pope and to the years and challenges ahead? What do you see? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by Stephen Pope, Associate Professor of Theology at Boston College. Stephen, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
We're joined right now from out where Catholics are keeping an eye on the Vatican, saying prayers, contemplating. We're joined by WBUR reporter Martha Biebinger. She joins us from the Cathedral of the Holy Cross in Boston. Martha, thank you for being with us tonight. What's the setting there, Martha? What's going on?
Tom, they had a special service this evening at 6 o'clock. About 100 people turned out. It was in the smaller chapel of this grand main church in downtown Boston. Right now, they are celebrating what they call the Eucharistic Adoration. It's a quiet time of prayer and reflection with the presence of the Eucharist in the chapel. And there are 25 or 30 people just meditating and praying for the Pope's speedy recovery or a peaceful death.
Martha, is it possible to convey the attitude, the mood? Is it grieving? Is it celebration? Is it coming to terms with what now seems inevitable? How would you characterize it?
You know, there's a great sense of a moment in history here of people. Many of the young people here have not known anyone but this Pope for their lifetime, and they're trying to come to grips with what it would mean to have a new church leader. Then you have some people from Poland here this evening who talk about the dramatic changes that he helped inspire and foment in Poland. And there are the older women of the church who see him as a possible saint someday. I mean, there's just such a broad picture of his legacy, both on the political sphere and the personal sphere here tonight.
And at this hour, quiet as people quietly pray and reflect.
There is a sense among some of the church leadership here that a lot of people are at home listening to the radio, watching TV, trying to come to terms both with what's happening in the moment and how they feel about it. They are preparing over the weekend, if the Pope does pass, for a great turnout. And many of the churches are going to be open through the night if people need this as a place to come to express whatever feelings they do have with whatever's happening.
WBUR reporter Martha Biebinger joining us from the Cathedral of the Holy Cross in Boston. Martha, thanks very much for being with
us. Thank you, Tom.
Stephen Pope, you were saying earlier that this is not just an event for Catholics, it's an event for the world. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I think if you you can quote Billy Graham, who one of the great American figures in religion, said that the Pope is the moral conscience of Christianity.
This a very Protestant evangelical preacher, Billy Graham, but saying that the Pope or this Pope in particular.
He said this of John Paul II.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure he would have said that about Pius XII for a variety of reasons. But I think many people regard him as the foremost figure in the last 25 years as a defender of human rights. And he's gone all over the world defending human rights. He went to the Philippines and criticized very prophetically Ferdinand Marcos.
Mm.
He criticized Stroessner in Paraguay and Pinochet in Chile. And, of course, we all know about what he did in Eastern Europe. He's fearless, and he is committed to speaking for the rights of people who are the most vulnerable, the most marginalized around the world.
And fascinatingly, as you say, as the first global pope via the media, whatever he would bring, and especially with his charisma, is going to bleed beyond the confines of the Catholic Church. He's no longer depending on mass being said, on messages being transmitted simply by the organization of the church. It's really echoed and magnified through the amplifier of media to all mm-hmm. kinds of listeners.
And I think that people have recognized his authentic concern for them, and they admire the fact that he doesn't use the media for any financial gain. There's no commercialism. There's no personal profit he gains from traveling all over the world, 177 trips. So people respect him and respect the fact that he's present to them in the favelas and the barrios in a way that no other person in the world is.
Even though not everyone, by any means, has agreed with him at every moment, a powerful figure. We're joined now from South Bend, Indiana, and Notre Dame University by Kathleen Caveney. She's professor of law and professor of theology at the University of Notre Dame. Kathleen Caveney, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
We want to hear exactly how you see what's going on in Rome and what's coming up, but first just your emotional response, your personal response to the events unfolding.
Well, I think it's hard for any Catholic, and indeed for many people of different faiths, to watch somebody who was as both a prayerful presence, but also a powerful presence to the world. He worked outward and he worked inward, going through something like this. And at the same time, I think he's a model of really something that's very hard for us all. If you connect this up to the, Schiavo case, how to go about dying, how to go about giving up one's life on this earth for eternal life. I think that that's a very hard thing for anyone to do. And the fact that he was willing to, in a way, share that with the world is something that's profoundly moving.
He shared the ravages of illness and that struggle. At the same time, he decided, we are told, that he did not want to go back to the hospital, that the time had come he would stay in his quarters at the Vatican and presumably die there.
Well, I think this is a pope who is very conscious of himself, not just as an academic who has written, an enormous amount of encyclicals and pastoral letters and material for theologians to work through, but somebody whose profound teaching comes through the way he lives, the way he models. And I think what he's trying to model here is both a sense that, human life is incredibly important, has tremendous dignity, yet that's not all there is. I mean, he's modeling his belief in salvation through Jesus Christ, and he's modeling his belief in an afterlife. And he's encouraging, I think, us to live it along with him so that when it comes to be our turn, we'll know how to live it better ourselves.
Oh. Kathleen Caveney, so many hugely dynamic issues came to be personified in this pope. He defied labels. He fought for social justice. At the same time, he was a fierce traditionalist, very conservative on social values. We feel these tension lines, not only within the Catholic Church, but beyond it today, and lots of them have run through Pope John Paul II. Look forward with us for a second. Do you see a kind of resolution of these tensions in the years beyond John Paul? How will they play out, these unresolved tensions in the Catholic Church and really beyond that he spoke to so forcefully?
Well, I think the task for theologians and moralists, within the church is going to be to incorporate his writings into the broader tradition. One of the things about having a tradition is that every thinker within it doesn't just stand alone, but stands in conversation with the people that came before and the people that come after. And the trouble with, working with John Paul II is that he is such a prolific thinker and such a powerful thinker that, it's hard enough while he's living just to grasp what he's saying. But then it needs, the rough edges need to be smoothed out. The peaks and the valleys need to be, looked at and put into the broader perspective and critiqued and perhaps revised in terms of some of the other values that the church holds. So I think that he's going to be giving theologians and ethicists a tremendous amount to do, putting him in his place in the context of a tradition as a thinker, not just as the reigning pope.
There's a lot of talk of culture war, cultural division in the United States these days, but the Catholic Church seems to have its own. I don't know if you see it mirroring some of these American dividing lines or as distinct. Is this a pope who leaves an unusual amount of internal division within the church itself? What about the cultural tensions?
Well, I actually think that's a very big problem coming up. And I actually think that's something that he himself would recognize as one of his one of the challenges he's leaving his successor. This is a pope who values unity, human being unity, unity with other churches, yet some could say that he sparked some division within the Catholic community, and one of the ways I think that this happened was the image he chose, to talk about the broader community. In Evangelium Vitae, he talked about the culture of life and its opposition to the culture of death, and that's been picked up, by President Bush, by the Republican Party, and I think in a way twisted out of context.
In what sense?
To say that there's, one black world and one white world, and I don't mean racially, obviously, but I mean morally clarity.
Good and evil.
Clarity, and that that you belong to one or the other. And I think that one of the things that will need to be done is to take that image and reintegrate it back into the church's image, which was more the city of God in working in the city of humanity, so that that we're all in this together, and that a war, even if we disagree, isn't the best way of understanding our disagreements.
I want to welcome our patient and long-waiting callers into this conversation. Gary's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Gary, you're on the air.
I just wanted to say that I grew up in Belfast, Northern Ireland, an ultra-Protestant, grew up in the rhetoric of Ian Paisley and folks like that, and as I was saying to your person that was on the phone earlier,
yes,
who took my call, that I for one will, and I'm not a praying man, tonight I will get on my knees and I will say a prayer for this pope.
You're a Protestant, Gary.
I'm a Protestant. I'm an ultra Protestant.
And what is it about this pope that will bring you to your knees?
I think he's just a great unifier of the world. I think he's probably done more than any pope in history, I think, to bring Catholics and Protestants together. He's been a tremendous presence on the world stage. And one of your speakers earlier had said that how he had this political impact on the world, and I certainly do believe that. I think it's going to be a great loss. And I kind of despair on who will come next. Hopefully that someone like him, like this pope, will carry the message to the world that, Protestants and Catholics can live together, and, of course, other religions, but especially from Ireland, with the conflict that we've had there for such a long time, and the division and the bitterness. And it's just, I think it's a very sad time. Very sad time for us.
We hear it, Gary, and we appreciate your call. There, a Protestant voice originally from Northern Ireland saying he will pray for this pope. Let's hear from Nino calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Nino, you're on the air.
Hi, it's Nino.
Nino, excuse me, yes.
Being a non-religious person, I'm really surprised about the level of emotion that I feel tonight.
And what do you think that's coming from, Nino?
Well, there are a couple of different levels. One, being a Croat, being from Croatia, the Pope was one of the biggest supporters of Croatian
independence.
Fight for independence, and stood with us even when that was not awfully popular. And then I don't know. I have very mixed feelings about his legacy, because he was definitely not women friendly by any stretch of imagination. And
to women within the church, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's somehow. To me, it's a conflict of trying to help poor, especially in developing world, and at the same time being against contraceptives and condoms. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, how do you reconcile that?
It's a complicated picture, and yet we can hear in your voice that, as you say, the emotion you feel tonight. Nino, thanks for your call. Let's get one more. John is calling from Waterbury, Connecticut. John, you're on the air.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, want to say that I'm from Brazil, and the major of Brazilian, they are Catholics. I'm a Protestant myself.
Yes.
But even among the Protestants, this Pope has had a big, big, big position.
Why do you think he's had that impact, that respect?
The first of all, the liberation of the Catholic Church, you know, for the revival of the Catholic Church, especially in Hispanic and Portuguese-speaking countries.
Yes.
You know, the people used to say the Catholic Church was a dead church. He just revival by allowing the women to speak more and participate more. The priests and the brothers, you know, the flags, and to get the leadership and show different ways and unifying the so-called Protestants.
So even as a Protestant in Brazil, you see the impact of this Pope. John, thanks for your call. Kathleen Caveney, as a woman at Notre Dame, how do you describe the legacy of this Pope when it comes to women and the Church?
Well, I think that that's a complicated question. On the one hand, I gave a talk at a Vatican conference on women's health issues, and we had an audience with the Pope, and he pointed to himself, and he said, "Papa Feminista." Feminist, I'm a feminist pope.
Do you give that credence? Do you believe that?
Well, I believe he believes that. And I believe that he did, you know, was taking steps to call for more equality for women in the world, to call for more equality, especially for women in developing countries.
But not in the church, not in the administration.
That's where it gets very tricky. I mean, I think you have to see the big picture first. Mm-hmm. And then what you see is that, you know, he does want more movement of women toward, you know, administrative rules in the roles in the church. But what he doesn't want is women priests. And he did, you know, fairly definitively shut the door to that question. Now, he will claim that this is consistent with honoring the equality of women. You know, a lot of women in the Catholic Church will say, you know, I really don't think that that's the case, because really the exclusion of women from the priesthood has really been justified on the grounds of the inequality of women all along. So that's a really neuralgic point, I think, among various people in the Church.
Huge footprints and much to be worked out on the other side of Pope John Paul II. Kathleen Caveney, Professor of Law and Professor of Theology at the University of Notre Dame, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome. Good night.
Good night. Stephen Pope, it's great to have you here. We're going to keep watching what's going on at the Vatican. Wonderful to have you with us. Listeners, I'm Tom Ashbrook. We continue our live coverage of events at the Vatican and the fate of John Paul II tonight. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.